If you want to pump your body and expand your mind, there's only one place to go. Mind Pump. Mind Pump. With your hosts, Sal DiStefano, Adam Schaefer, and Justin Andrews.
Stephanie Cohen,
yeah.
One of the strongest, if not the, well, definitely the strongest female in her weight class.
Oh,
one
of the strongest girl I've ever even met.
One of the strongest women in the world ever. And, you know, she's this tiny thing. She's like barely 5 feet tall, 120 something pounds. This girl has lifted weights that were thought to be impossible.
I think four times her body weight.
Yeah, 530-pound deadlift. Squats with 400 pounds on her Instagram page. She's also very smart. She's a doctor of physical therapy, so she understands movement and correctional exercise at a much higher level than most strength athletes. So in this episode, you know, we talk a little bit about her past, and then things get really technical. So if you're into the technical aspect of lifting, if you're into learning how to prevent your body from getting injured, how to utilize mobility training and flexibility training to improve your performance.
We talk about some of the difference between mobility and flexibility and just some of the nuances of that. And so you can kind of peer into that a little bit in this episode.
That's right. She's a 22-time world record holder. And her website is hybridperformancemethod.com. And then her Instagram page is awesome because you can see her lift weights that I swear you'd think they're fake. But she competes in competition, so you know she's as strong as she says she is. Her Instagram page is at Steffi Cohen. That's S-T-E-F-I-C-O-H-E-N. And before we get into the episode, I want to let everybody know that Maps Anywhere, the program that we created that's designed to get people fit, strong, healthy, lean, muscular,
anywhere,
without any equipment, without any weights, without gym. All you need is your body, maybe some bands, and you can follow Maps Anywhere. That program is 50% off. So here's what you do to get the 50% off. Go to mapswhite.com. That's MAPSWHITE.com and use the code ANYWHERE50. That's ANYWHERE50. No space for the discount. So without any further ado, here we are talking to the incredibly strong Dr. Stephanie Cohen. I think the first time I heard about you was somebody tagged me on you deadlifting. I don't know what it was. It was like 400 pounds and you were doing reps with it. And
probably 500.
Maybe. Yeah, make me feel worse. And you're tiny. You're like 5 foot tall. How much do you, what are you, 120 pounds?
On a, yeah.
Yeah, around
on
there.
On a good day. On a bad day, about 125, 128.
Fine. You weigh
like
as much.
Define the laws of gravity. Yeah. It's impressive as hell.
Yeah, you weigh as much as a dumbbell in one of the gyms. You're tiny, but you're incredibly, insanely strong. If I'm not mistaken, you're I think you're the first female to deadlift three times her body weight, if I'm not mistaken.
Four times.
God, he keeps like undercutting
I
you.
Know. Yeah. I think it's
give her real props.
I think it's my ego trying to make me feel
better. Yeah, I know, right? Me too.
I mean, that is beyond impressive. It's an incredible feat of strength. So when I saw the on Instagram, then I instantly started going through your videos and I couldn't believe some of the stuff you were doing. But I'd like to kind of go back and take it back to kind of where this all started. Now, you're originally from Venezuela, correct?
Mm-hmm.
How old were you when you came here?
I was 17.
Okay. So 17, yeah. So you spent a lot of your life living in Venezuela. What brought you guys to the U.S.?
You know, it's interesting. My mom really had a vision and just kind of knew or felt that the situation in Venezuela politically, economically wasn't going to improve. So she was the one that really pushed me to pursue. At that time, I was playing soccer. I played for the national team back in Venezuela.
Oh, okay.
And and she was the one that kind of pushed me to try to get a soccer scholarship here in the States. And obviously, you know, pursue a higher level of education. And so initially, I got a soccer scholarship to play in San Diego State. And that was kind of the first place that I moved when I came here.
Oh, now did the whole family come with you at that point?
No, I came alone.
Okay. Are your parents still over there?
My dad is still there. They're divorced. And my mom eventually moved to Chicago.
Okay.
And so did my sister.
Wow. What your mom was on point, because the situation over there, from what I've read, is very difficult.
Yeah, I was so lucky. Like I moved at the right time, for sure.
Mm. And so you still have a lot of family over there. Is everybody okay with the whole, or are you able to be in contact with them and see what's going on?
Being in contact is really difficult because now they started shutting down the internet and communication networks. So you know, sometimes I'll go a couple days without really hearing from my dad or without him being able to communicate. So it's difficult. And it's gone to a point, my dad used to have a business there. He used to manufacture sunscreen and shampoo and different cosmetics like that. And now he can't even find like the materials to make them. And obviously, even if he did, so he had like a set amount of products that they were already finished, but he can't even sell them because people don't have money. So it's gotten to a point where there's really nowhere else to go.
Is the situation as bad as I've read, where people starving and having a difficult time just finding food and whatnot?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
Everything you've seen in the news probably amplify that times five.
Wow. Now coming here to obviously a completely different, now we're dysfunctional in our own ways, but to a country that is obviously has a polar opposite approach when it comes to economics and politics and all that stuff, does it make you see things and value things a little bit differently?
Absolutely. I mean, things that you would take for granted, like just being able to leave your house and not being scared of whether someone got inside of your house, or being able to get inside of your house without being scared that someone followed you in, or walking down the streets, or being able to get your driver's license in a day, or having a passport. Mm. You know, they're not even giving away passports anymore. Or being able to go to the grocery store and find your favorite olive oil. Just simple things like that.
Wow. Now, you obviously have a tremendous work ethic. You're very young. You're in your mid to late 20s, and you have incredible accomplishments. Did some of that drive come from the fact that you came from a place where things were not as accessible, not as much opportunity coming here? And did some of your work ethic come from the fact that you're like, I'm taking advantage of these opportunities?
Yeah, I think to a certain degree, you're forced to rise up to the occasion. When you grow up and stay in the same place where you were born, it is easier in the sense that, you know, probably your parents already have a lot of connections. It's a more sense of security, essentially, where you almost feel like you don't have to put that much work in order to succeed. Whereas like when you move alone by yourself to a new country or a new city, then you're kind of forced to making your own path, essentially. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's how I felt, at least, moving to a different country. I just felt like I was a race against the clock, just a constant hustle, just trying to figure out what I'm good at, what were some of my talents, just trying to figure out different things that I thought could, one, make me happy, but two, I could also be good at, essentially. Now,
so you come here for soccer. Did you immediately also enter into, because you have your PhD in physical therapy?
Yeah, it's a doctorate.
Doctorate, sorry. Mm-hmm. Was that where you went initially? You're like, I'm going to learn physical therapy and stay in that field? Or was it something different?
No, to be honest, I really had no idea what I wanted to do. I started as an architecture major in college and quickly realized that's not what I wanted to do. And I switched majors about five different times after that. I switched to engineering. I switched to marketing, business, nursing, pre-med, and eventually exercise physiology. So it took me 5 years to graduate. I took classes every single summer. So I never had a summer off because I was always behind, right? Because I was switching majors almost every year until I finally landed in exercise physiology, which from a standpoint of my genuine interest was the perfect thing to do. But from a career standpoint, maybe not so much, because I don't know, anyone who studied exercise physiology knows that there's not a big market for us after you graduate college. So maybe not the best business move to do, because after I graduated college, I realized there's the only option I had was probably being a fitness manager at a gym, a facility, or working at a hospital conducting exercise fitness tests, you know, VO2 max and cardio tests and educating people about nutrition. But that's kind of as far as the scope extends for an exercise physiologist.
But you had a passion for it, which is probably why you got into it.
I loved it. Yeah, I loved it. But I also love making money. I'm ambitious.
Of course.
So, you know, it was tough. So that's when the idea of going to physical therapy came up. I wasn't sure where I wanted to take my career. And physical therapy at least had the other portion of what I was looking for, which was, I don't want to say validation, but maybe personally, I wanted to do something more for myself. I wanted to achieve the highest level of education for the field that I wanted to be in. And in my opinion, that was physical therapy. If I wanted to be a strength coach, if I wanted to be a personal trainer, I wanted to know the most that a personal trainer could know, the most that a fitness professional could know.
Yeah, I've worked with quite a few physical therapists, and some are obviously better than others, but I'm always, almost always impressed at their level of just the understanding of human function, and especially with the application of correctional exercise. And you have videos on YouTube and on your Instagram page where you're talking about mobility and whatnot, and the way you present it, you can tell you have a very deep understanding of just movement and of the human body. And I really appreciate it, especially from someone who's at your level in the field that you compete in, which I want to get into. How did you switch from soccer to powerlifting? They seem like they're not connected at all.
Did it happen while you were training through that process? You know, when you're training for soccer, did you really enjoy that process versus actually playing? Because I know for me, playing football, I tended to enjoy the off season a little bit more just because of the process of, you know, bettering myself in the weight room. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you experienced as well?
It's funny because when I say that I played soccer at for the national team in Venezuela, you're probably picturing something really prestigious. But we had a corner in the kind of like the, it was the military training field where we trained at. So we would post up, you know, a goalie that was not permanent, and we would have just a corner in their military field. And that's where 95% of our training would take place. The other 5% would be our condition, or 10%, let's say 90 and 10% would take place on the beach. That would be our conditioning session where we would play soccer just on the sand. Mm-hmm. And that's it. We didn't have access to a fitness room. Wow. We didn't have access to weights.
You just played soccer.
Yeah,
we just played soccer. We just refined a skill. We were really good. We were actually the first female soccer, Venezuelan soccer team that ever happened.
Oh, cool.
So we kind of like pioneered it. We had nothing. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, I didn't know. I didn't lift weights until I was 21.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just basically a result of when I stopped playing soccer, I was just... Similar story to college when I was just trying to figure out something that I was good at that I also enjoyed. Same thing happened with sports. I stopped playing soccer and I immediately started looking for different things. I did half marathons for a while. I did 8 in 1 year, just trying to see if I can improve myself. Yeah, ended up being not too bad. I think my best time was like 1:35.
Oh, that's fast.
Yeah,
that's so it was really good. Fast. Then, so you're one of those annoying
you're
people.
Just a born athlete.
Yeah, you're good at all the physical stuff. Yeah.
I'm not. I just stick to the things that I'm really good at and dump the ones that I'm not.
Okay.
So, you just get hyper focused.
Yeah, but I know when to quit. Mm-hmm. So if I tried, say, skateboarding, which I did, I quickly realized that I was afraid of falling, and that's it. Just a fear that I was never gonna be able to get over.
I see.
You know. Mm-hmm. So I tried it for a couple of weeks and then quit. I even bought my own skateboard, and I was criticized by my parents, by my boyfriend at the time, that I was a quitter. But in my head, I wasn't. I was just a realist.
Mm.
Hey, you know, I'm going to try this. I don't have the skills that are necessary. Or
it's not a good fit.
It's not a good fit for me. Yeah. So I'm just not going to do it. I'm going to go look for something that I'm good at.
Mm-hmm. So you started lifting weights and you felt right away like this is for me.
So I started doing CrossFit. That was kind of my first exposure to it. You know, Noah Olson? He's a CrossFitter.
Okay.
He's a CrossFitter in Miami. He went to school with me in the same program, and he trained at a gym that was a couple miles away from school. And he was the one that said, hey, maybe, you know, you'll enjoy doing this. So I went there, and obviously there's like 9 different disciplines, well, however many different disciplines that you need to be good at in order to be a good CrossFitter.
Mm-hmm.
The one that I was the worst at was weights. So Olympic weightlifting and obviously anything related to strength, because I had never done it before.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, you know, maybe I need to just focus all of my energy into first mastering these two, getting stronger and getting better at Olympic lifting, and then I'll be able to be a better CrossFitter. But obviously, I never went back to CrossFit.
Mm-hmm.
I just kind of started doing Olympic weightlifting. I found a coach that used to coach at the national level in Cuba and in Venezuela, and he kind of just took me under his wing, and that was my segue into lifting weights.
Now, did your body respond? Did you find yourself responding very quick? I mean, obviously, you're an athlete, so you probably, genetically speaking, obviously, at the level you're at now, this goes without saying, but you've got really, really good genes. I would assume that your body responded very quickly early on. Like, were people like, whoa, you're really strong for your size?
Yes.
Wow. And what did that feel like to you? And this is important to communicate, because I think a lot of women sometimes are afraid of lifting weights, but I don't think they realize how empowering it can feel to get stronger.
Yeah, what was your initial impression? I mean, that pursuing that and like the real strength aspect of that, was that appealing to you initially? Or?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's what I was going to say, that it was extremely empowering just as a girl, just to do things that girls aren't supposed to do. be able to step to the other side of the gym where the weights are at, you know, where there's no girls at all, and you just go in and grab the heaviest dumbbell or just start cranking squats with two plates, and all the guys are just looking at you in awe. Can't even believe it. That's empowering on its own. So
while you're doing this, are you also noticing that your body's developing muscle fast, or are you one of those people that you were just strong and muscle came on a little slower?
So mentally, obviously, that was one of the other appeals about lifting weights as a female that I found to be incredible was that, and I think most girls are like that. You're working out because you want to look a certain way.
Yeah, most guys and girls, everybody, I'd say.
Yeah, kind of like that. And it's common, just body dysmorphia in the fitness industry in general is a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it was nice for me to be able to switch my mind from, hey, what can I do to look this way to what can I do to lift this much?
Oh.
So just that kind of switch in mentality was liberating.
I felt
freed.
I'm so happy you said that because that was a strategy that I used with clients. More often than not, female clients, because I just think generally speaking, they tend to have more issues with body image. And we can, you know, that's a whole separate discussion about, you know, society and advertising and all that stuff. But when they would come to me with these body image issues, one of the best strategies I had at helping them, you know, get out of it or improve was to shift their focus from how they looked to how they performed. And the place I would push their focus would be strength.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked very, very well. And you're saying that it did that for you too.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's
because
awesome.
Because also it's, strength is a long-term adaptation, right? You don't get strong from lifting weights for 2 weeks. And for some reason, that's a lot easier to accept than I want to look good and I want that now.
Great point.
Yeah.
That's a great point. How did you do powerlifting from here?
So from there, I did Olympic weightlifting for 3 years. I even have the Olympic rings, half of them tattooed on my arm. I took that very seriously. I wanted to go to the Olympics. I was very good. Then I got into grad school. And I mean, I don't know if you know what competitive Olympic weightlifting entails, but in order to be really, really good, you have to train a lot. So I'm talking about 9 training sessions a week. And you need to be supervised by a coach because it's so highly skilled, the movements, that you need to have someone looking at you and being like, hey, that snatch was 1 inch forward. You need to pull more. You need to be more explosive. Hey, your mind is not into it today. You have to come back in the afternoon. You need to have someone looking at you and pushing you because it's so mentally demanding.
Mm-hmm. Steph, I want to stop you there because that's a very important point that you made. The Olympic lifts, as effective and awesome as they are easily the most complex technical barbell movements that you could possibly do.
By far.
One of our biggest criticisms of CrossFit is that they include Olympic lifts in fatigue-based training, which, you know, form breaks down and they tend to be, you know, really dangerous. Did you identify this as you were doing Olympic training and saying, oh, this is not, we probably shouldn't be doing this in a circuit?
Yeah. I mean, yes and no. I like to believe that there's really no bad movements, just people who aren't prepared for movements. So that's kind of like the ideology that I subscribe to. So I think the main issue there is people are unprepared and they're throwing them into these classes without having adequate shoulder overhead mobility, without having enough thoracic extension, without having sufficient lumbopelvic control. And they're being thrown into these dynamic movements that require a lot of skill. And they don't have the prerequisite mobility requirements and they don't have the prerequisite skill to be doing that in that setting.
It takes a long time.
That's the biggest issue.
It takes a long time.
And right. Which is why I took a step back from CrossFit and I said, hey, and I didn't know much. I just said, hey, it doesn't make much sense for me to be doing this movement 60 times that I don't know how to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going to not do it. And every time that a snatch or a clean and jerk would come up in a WOD, I would just substitute it for something else. And then I would spend a lot of time trying to develop the skill of snatch and clean and jerk.
Incredible intuition on your part. Probably saved your body lots of injuries, especially with your competitive nature. A lot of people fall into that trap. So Olympic lifting, because it's so technical, you're just doing a lot of frequency, a lot of training, a lot of coaching. And you're saying that you shied away from that because you had so much school.
Oh yeah. So then I got into grad school and, obviously that was the first time in my life where I had to accept that I was no longer an athlete first. I was a professional student at that time.
Mm.
So my school had the requirement that you had to go there attendance was 100% mandatory. So I had to be there for 8 hours a day. which obviously made it extremely difficult for me to be able to do two training sessions a day, right? Initially, I tried to make it happen. So I moved in with a roommate from undergrad who did the same exercise physiology program as me. And I walked in the first day. She was already living there. I walked in and I see the living room and I'm like, hey, her name's Mariel. Hey, Mariel, what do you think if we get rid of all the furniture in the living room? You know, the couch, the TV, the table, everything. We get rid of all of that. And we put a squat rack and a platform.
Yeah.
Right?
That's perfectly normal. What did Mariel say to that?
She was all about it.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Nice. She's like, wow. Oh, yeah, that'd be awesome. So we turned our living room into a training space in a second floor of a really tiny and old apartment complex. And initially, that's what was allowing me to do my two training sessions. So I would do one in the morning, either before class, you know, 6 a.m, or I would come back during lunchtime. I would do my first training session then. And then in the afternoon, I would go to a gym. Or during midterms or finals week, that's where I would do all my training. So my training session would last 6 hours because I would go do 3 squats and then sit down and study or, you know, for 10 minutes to like whatever I had to do.
What were the conversations like when you guys would invite people over? Like you're on a date, they haven't seen your apartment yet. They walk in, they see weights. Like,
people thought we were insane. For sure. Especially people under us.
Because of the banging.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sure they loved you.
What the hell are you doing there?
So how did you switch to powerlifting, which is, obviously less technical, but also very grueling.
Sorry. I feel like I keep going around that.
Yeah, no problem.
So yeah, eventually it got really hard for me to be able to maintain the level of training that I needed in order to keep improving, and most of my training sessions became bad ones. From a mental standpoint, I was just tired. I was not there from a focus standpoint, and I wasn't enjoying it anymore. Really, I would leave most of my training sessions. I would leave before finishing because I just felt like I wasn't going anywhere. So that's when I met Hayden, and Hayden suggested, "Hey, maybe kind of similar to what happened with CrossFit. Maybe just try to get stronger, and that will get your Olympic weightlifting better." Mm. And I said, okay, so instead of snatching, clean and jerking 9 times per week, I started doing it 2 times per week or 3 times per week. And the rest of the sessions were just strength related. It's a lot easier to grind through a heavy squat or a heavy deadlift session than it is heavy snatch session. Mm-hmm. If you're not there, that snatch isn't, if 50% of us, your snatch isn't going anywhere, that's staying in the ground. Mm-hmm. Whereas a squat, you can grind.
Mm. And so as you're doing these lifts, your strength is going up, up, up.
And I'm feeling better. You know, I don't have to spend that much time in the gym. I'm getting stronger. I'm looking better because I'm focusing more on hypertrophy and on strength. It doesn't require that much mental concentration. So I'm just feeling better all around.
When did you do your first powerlifting competition? And when did you realize like, okay, I think I'm going to be one of the best?
So a couple months after I made the switch, I tried sumo deadlifting, and I think I was able to pull 315 the first time I did it.
Wow.
When my conventional deadlift was like 250 maybe.
Wow. That's ridiculous. So, I mean, 120 pound or whatever, and your first deadlift, 315.
Sumo deadlift,
that's enraging.
So then, so that's when I decided to compete, and I had a fun time. I think the contrast between the Olympic weightlifting community and the powerlifting community was interesting to see as well.
Like what? Like what are the contrasts?
Do they battle? I didn't even know about that.
I mean, I don't know if battle is the right word, but they're just different in their own ways. I mean, Olympic weightlifting is a lot more formal. When you go to compete in an Olympic weightlifting meet, it's not that fun. Like, people take it really seriously, like too seriously. Mm. Hey, it's a local meet, you know?
Yeah, chill
just
out.
Relax. Let's all have fun, you know?
So it's
don't
way
mean
more
mug
fun vibe.
Me across a room.
Yeah.
You know? Whereas powerlifting felt a lot more inclusive, more supportive. People help you out in the warm-up room, they help load your bar, they make you feel like you're a part of something, and that all was very appealing to me.
Oh, that's awesome. Now, meanwhile, you're going to school, learning, biomechanics, learning how the body moves, and are you applying what you're learning to your training to improve your performance or prevent injury at this point?
It was a little bit difficult because I could be wrong. I don't know what's being taught in other schools, but I felt like in my program, the beliefs were a little bit antiquated as far as what lifting does to your body.
Oh, you mean at school it was antiquated? What were they saying that was antiquated?
I mean, I had a spine professor that kept telling me that I was going to break my back from deadlifting.
Oh, geez.
Wow.
Yeah.
That it's obviously it's not true, but he's a professor, so obviously I was holding him to a certain standard. I thought that I was believing what he was saying to a certain degree, but obviously that wasn't going to make me stop deadlifting. Mm-hmm. But it was a tough point for sure. Because mm-hmm. on one hand, I obviously wanted to keep powerlifting. On the other hand, I had these people with a lot of authority telling me that it wasn't the best, or that mm-hmm. it was dangerous, that I shouldn't be doing it. I shouldn't be advertising it. I shouldn't be promoting it.
Mm. So let's move fast forward to the point where you were able to pull over 500 pounds off the floor. Was that your goal? Was your goal to be the first person to pull four times body weight? What did your training and diet look like to get to that point, to be able to do that just insane feat of strength?
No, I don't think it was a goal that I set for myself when I first started. I never thought it was possible. It was an all-time world record, so it was in fact not possible until I did it.
Mm.
But what did it look like? I'm trying to think. It looked like a lot of ups and downs. The first time I pulled 500 was coming back from an awful low back injury. I think I spent 3 months rehabbing it, and then 2 more months until I got back to that 500 pound after being stuck in a plateau at like 460, around 460 for a long time.
Mm.
So it looked like a lot of ups and downs, a lot of frustration, a lot of failing.
Do you think the back injury, let's talk about that for a second. Do you think the back injury gave you a different perspective that allowed you to get stronger afterwards? Do you think that was part of why you were able to break through your plateaus?
Yes. That was the first injury that I personally had that required me to take time off, dedicated time off. And the reason why it required that versus people that are able to just work around that injury and keep going to the gym and doing other things was because I was so stubborn. I thought that I was indestructible. I thought that I could, even though I was hurt, I thought that I could keep showing up to the gym and that it was going to resolve on its own. So just having that injury taught me that sometimes you need to take a step back and you need to identify what the cause of the issue actually is, and you need to take the steps required to fix it, essentially.
Now how did you navigate around that? Were you looking outside to see who's like a back specialist or somebody's information out there besides you're obviously going to school for this, but mm-hmm. Was there anybody out there too that had really good information that you're trying to get to help you through this process?
Yeah, so the first person that I got exposed to was Stuart McGill, because he's kind of a lead researcher in low back pain. And so I bought all of his books and didn't read them from start to finish, but took snippets here and there, listened to a bunch of his podcasts and a bunch of his YouTube videos, looked at what other people were doing, were saying, looked on social media to see what kind of advice was being given about low back pain, and then tried to make it work for me, essentially.
What, in a nutshell, would you be able to kind of talk about what his philosophy is around? Because I hear his name all the time when it comes to low back pain. I know
he's the first name that pops up all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Our friend Lane Norton went to him for his back problems. And you, in a nutshell, I have kind of an idea of kind of how he talks about back pain. And a lot of it comes across as, don't deviate from, you know, a particular type of posture and move in this way all the time, which to me sounds, I could see some of the benefit of it, but I can also see some of the detriment being a personal trainer, knowing that that's just not life. Your body moves in all kinds of different directions and ways. How could you characterize kind of his philosophy around back pain? Like, what are some of the things he communicates?
I think most of his views are mechanistic in nature. So he believes that the main cause of someone's low back pain has to be able to be identified following a thorough evaluation. So that's why his evals are so lengthy, take so much time, because he really believes that if you sit down and do a bunch of provocation tests, that you should be able, that anyone should be able to identify what the actual source of someone's low back pain is.
Okay. Once he identifies it through his testing, then is his approach different than, or does he have a unique approach to correcting these issues?
Yeah. So then that's where the McGill Big Three came up. So he's all about increasing stiffness and stability through the McGill Big Three and other different exercises that are essentially isometric exercises to increase stiffness or stability in the low back or in the segment that's unstable.
Okay.
That's the premise.
And then do you have any differing opinions with his approach, or do you agree with it? Because it seems like his research kind of dominates that field. I don't know of too many. Are there other people that you look to when it comes to low back research?
Yeah. Have you heard of Greg Lehman?
Mm-mm.
Greg Lehman is a doctor in chiropractic. He also has a master's in biomechanics, and I think he also went to physical therapy school.
Okay.
So this guy is like on another level.
Okay. Is it different than McGill's approach?
Yes. So I do want to add something about McGill's approach that I think I agree with. So part of his evaluation is identifying what the cause of pain, what the movement that's causing pain is, and essentially trying to avoid that movement and trying to do more of the movements that don't cause pain. Mm-hmm. So you call someone either flexion intolerant or extension intolerant.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're someone that bending over causes you pain, then you're said to be flexion intolerant. If you're someone that bending backwards causes you pain, then you're extension intolerant. And essentially he just tells you, hey, okay, don't maybe avoid.
It's an avoidance sort of mentality.
Yes. Avoid forward bending for, I don't know, an arbitrary amount of time that he determines.
Mm-hmm.
And let's do more of prone press-ups. Let's do more Supermans, Ironmans, however you want to call it. Let's do more bird dogs and extension, that kind of stuff. And just avoid this movement for X amount of time.
Hmm.
And it almost makes it seem how he explains this as it's a little bit, or to me, it's a little bit of fear-mongering
mm-hmm.
on his part to just deem this particular movement as bad and this other one as good. So I think you just have to be careful about how you present that information to people, because we know that what you tell people can definitely exacerbate their pain just based on how you're presenting that information.
Mm. Yeah. And it reminds me of, you know, when I would train people and they'd come see me and they'd say, doctor told me not to squat anymore. And I said, well, you know, how come? Oh, it hurts my knees, so I'm not mm-hmm. going to squat anymore. And I'd think to myself, like, well, squatting is, that's a basic human function. I think the idea is for us to figure out a way to get you to be able to squat again without pain, because that's a, you know, that decreases your quality of life, not being able to squat. And that's why sometimes I shy away from that. Like, don't do that because it hurts.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, well, what if that is a basic human function?
Mm-hmm.
Are the things I can do to move towards being able to get back into that position again without hurting? This other researcher you mentioned, Lehman, I think
Greg
his
Lehman,
name.
Yeah.
How is his approach different?
So he talks about, first of all, giving a definition about stability, what stability actually is, and kind of challenges the idea of how can you actually determine whether or not there's an unstable segment, and why does that segment have to be unstable? That's his whole premise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you know that someone has an instability in the low back? Why do you think you need to fix it? And what makes you think that the pain is arising from that?
Mm. That's I like that, because referred pain is a real thing, and oftentimes the pain comes from areas you might not even anticipate or expect.
Mm-hmm.
You were mentioning before we went on air that there are these general steps that most people can take to alleviate pain, although there's an individual application. I'm interested in hearing what your general steps are for pain.
Okay, yeah. And I have them here written down because I didn't want to miss anything.
No problem.
So obviously the first one is stop doing what hurts.
Mm-hmm.
And this one is super obvious, but a lot of people miss it. You know, they don't want to stop doing what hurts, especially fitness people. They don't want to stop snatching, clean and jerking, squat, bench, and deadlift because they think they're going to lose their gains. But it's absolutely necessary. You need to stop doing whatever movement is aggravating for a certain period of time in order to let that tissue heal if there's an actual tissue damage, or just in order to calm down the pain in that particular area.
Mm-hmm.
So that's your first one. Then obviously understanding that tissue adaptation takes time. In order for tissues to get stronger, essentially they need to be exposed to stress. So think about, for example, people that get a total knee replacement or a total hip replacement. What is the first thing that they do when they wake up? They walk.
Right.
They walk. Or someone that has something in their heart. You have to stress the heart in order for that heart, for the vessels in the heart to essentially produce or go through angiogenesis, which is the process of creating new vessels that go into the heart, and in order for the heart to get stronger as well.
Right. So there's appropriate stress.
Appropriate stress.
Mm-hmm.
And also in that process, it's important to understand that everyone responds to it differently, and everyone has a different amount of time that it takes them to heal. So it's common for people to just go online and say, oh, what's the healing time for a hamstring strain? And it says 6 weeks. And then maybe your hamstring strain takes 8 weeks. And at 6 weeks, you show up to the gym and you try deadlifting. Mm-hmm. It's just understanding, hey, healing time is different for everyone. Don't go based on something that you see online. Just go based on how you feel and what your pain tolerance is and trying not to exceed that at that particular point in time.
Yeah, that's got to be one of the biggest ones, is like listen to your body. I can't tell you how many times people come to me with, oh, I've been doing the keto diet for 3 months and I'm constipated and I feel terrible. How long am I supposed to feel bad? I'm like, okay, it's probably not for you. Maybe try something different. And that one piece of advice right there, listen to your body, I think applies to, I mean, all aspects of life, but mm-hmm. especially when it comes to your workouts mm-hmm. and your nutrition.
Exactly. Yeah, because people always try to get the answer from something external, whether that's your therapist or the internet, and they wholeheartedly believe on what those people are saying and ignore everything that's on their inside. How are they feeling? Are they actually prepared to do this particular movement based on their pain tolerance and so on?
Mm-hmm.
Then the third one is educating them about pain. So we know that pain doesn't always indicate that there's tissue damage. You can have a lot of pain and very little tissue damage. You can have, you know, it varies. They're not directly correlated.
Yeah, I know. So a lot of times, I used to train a lot of surgeons and doctors, and I trained one surgeon who did a lot of back surgeries, and he'd say it's remarkable how many times people have bulging discs or issues and they're asymptomatic. They have no pain. And other times when people have all this excruciating pain and they cannot find anything wrong with them, pain can also be entirely psychological. Mm-hmm. People who are depressed experience pain differently than people who are, you know, happy or you know, feeling good. Stimulants can impact how you feel about pain. So that's an important one to communicate, I think, because pain is such a subjective thing,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I have a cool analogy here to kind of try to explain it. There's a big, I don't want to say fad or craze, but there's a big push, especially from physical therapists now, about the biopsychosocial model of pain. And they're trying to push that into their patients, just trying to explain to them how pain works and that pain starts in your brain. And I feel like it's a hard message to get across when people are in pain because, you know, your knee hurts.
It's real to them, right?
It's real to them, exactly. Yeah. So how do you actually convey that message without making them feel like they're crazy or that their pain is not there or that it's less than what they're perceiving, right? This analogy came from actually one of Greg Lehman's book, that pain is like an alarm. An alarm, like a smoke detector. It doesn't really tell you whether or not there's actually a fire, and it doesn't tell you how much smoke there is. Sometimes that alarm can, for some reason, is more sensitive to stuff that's in the air, and it can go off for no reason. Pain is similar to that, and it's very much so emotion and context dependent. Obviously, pain is something that's there to tell you do something about this, but it doesn't always tell you exactly what that is.
Is there a way that you describe to your patients like how to identify what type of pain it is or like what kind of signal your body is telling you? Like, because I know it varies so much, right?
Yeah, I don't know. Not that I know of.
Hmm.
Not that I know of. But we just know that in the take-home message is pain doesn't always indicate tissue damage. And so...
It just means something.
Yeah.
It just means something. Yeah. Right, it means, right. Hey, take action.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe don't move this way or try to avoid this position or... Maybe take it down a notch. Don't squat 7 times a week.
Yeah, and especially for athletes, we learn to ignore pain to a certain extent because some pain is okay, like when you're working out hard, mm-hmm. when you're getting sore, when you're feeling exhausted, and then, of course, the competitive aspect of it. And so when you combine those two, sometimes you create the perfect storm of just ignoring pain. You just keep going, push through it, which
absolutely.
Is a disaster for a lot of people.
Absolutely.
Is that what happened to you when your back started hurting? Were you just kind of like, I'm going to keep going?
Yeah.
See what happens.
I was just totally ignoring it.
Wow.
Yeah.
What exactly happened to your back? Was it, you don't know? Okay.
I went to 4 different therapists and got 4 different diagnoses.
Interesting.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. Did you notice any compensations as a result of it? Like going back into, you know, doing your workouts?
No, like as far as how my movement looked?
Yeah.
No, not really. I was just really stiff.
Hmm.
Was having a lot of trouble bending forward.
Did you change
load on my back?
Did you change anything afterwards? Do you have like a different warm up or priming session that you do now that you didn't do before because of it?
Yeah, there are several things that I changed.
Hmm. Would you mind going into what they are, what the things that you do now?
Yeah, absolutely. One thing was just monitoring the load better. Before, I was just go all the time. It doesn't matter whether I did a heavy squat or a heavy deadlift. I would go again for a heavy squat at the end of the week without really paying attention to how that was actually affecting my body. You know, we know that, for example, bone remodeling takes a certain amount of time from, so say that you load your back and there's your bones need to recover from that for a certain amount of time before you're able to load them again safely. That's just one example. Obviously, mm-hmm. all tissues respond to load in that same way. So muscles and tendons and ligaments also need time to recover after you've put them through something strenuous like lifting a ton of weight.
Mm.
So I've just gotten better at understanding how much weight I can do in a certain week before I start getting those aches and pains and before that margin of safety starts getting really, really small.
Mm.
And I start exposing myself to more injuries.
Now, is this based off of feel, or do you now look at it and write it out and say, okay, no matter what, you know, I do heavy deadlift or heavy squat this time a week, and no matter what, the next session is going to be lighter and easier and maybe focused more on form. Do you do it that way, or do you still just go off of feel?
A combination. So understanding how much work I'm doing every week. And if I have to, obviously, in order for you to get stronger, there needs to be a certain amount of progressive overload every week.
Mm-hmm.
So just making sure that you account, you're aware of how much work you're doing in a specific week and that it has a logical progression that's not too steep or too aggressive from week to week.
Mm-hmm.
And then accepting that even though you might be planning for everything, your body might not be on the same page as you.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So it's just that combination.
And the irony of this is, some of us take a long time to learn this. I did. You actually progress faster. So it's like the idea, you know, the problem with always training hard before is you think that's what's going to make you progress faster. But mm-hmm. the reality is when you do what you're saying now, you actually get faster results. It's like you're working with your body versus against it.
Absolutely.
Every single time. So there's a lot of confusion in our space around the difference between like flexibility and mobility, for example. Would you mind going into the differences between like, what does it mean to be flexible?
Yeah, define the two, because I know. Yeah,
and what is mobile?
It's confusing.
Right.
Well, we know that flexibility doesn't necessarily pertain to the length that a muscle can change to in order to allow you to do a specific movement, but it's more so central nervous system dependent. So your brain essentially is controlling how much tension that muscle's going to have at a particular point in time. And that's what you can train yourself to be able to tolerate more stretch or less stretch, but there's not a real change in muscle length or muscle fibers at that particular point in time. Whereas mobility, I think there's many definitions, but I more so interpret it as related to joints.
Mm.
You know, can you access different or full range of motion in a particular joint?
Mm-hmm. Now, for athletes who require flexibility, is it just flexibility, or is it the ability to be able to connect to different ranges of motion? In other words, can I just get flexible, or should I be able to own that range of motion through?
Is that even a good idea to get flexible?
Yeah.
A lot of times.
It depends on the sport. So there's a couple of examples that I usually draw from. For example, sprinters. Sprinters need to have really tight calves in order to be able to generate the most amount of power when they touch the ground every stride.
Mm.
So would it be a good idea for them to be stretching out their calves, their calf muscles? Probably not, because those muscles need to be tightly wound in order mm-hmm. for them to be able to produce the most amount of force into the ground. Another example is basketball players. We know that the hamstrings attach to the back of your leg bone, the back of your tibia, and so they actually are protective against one of the major injuries that basketball players suffer from, which is ACL injuries.
Mm.
And so would it be a good idea for basketball players to stretch their hamstrings aggressively before a game? Or do you want those suckers to be taut and to be able to resist against translational forces when they switch directions?
In other words, and correct me if I'm wrong, as the hamstrings lengthen, you want them to have a certain amount of tension to provide that support. If you do lots of static stretching before the game, static stretching being I'm sitting there, it's a classic stretching, right? What you did in PE, where I'm sitting there holding the stretch of my hamstring. Now I've told my central nervous system not to hold so much tension in this stretch position. That's going to provide me with less stability and potentially increase my risk of injury.
Yeah, and less ability for those muscles to generate force. Mm. Imagine if a muscle is like a rubber band. How do you want that rubber band? How would that rubber band be able to generate the most tension when you leave it, when you stretch it out for the entire night and then you go grab it, it's all loose, or if it's tight?
Mm. So how should somebody then, before an athletic event, before powerlifting competition, before basketball or any sport, how should they get their bodies ready then? It sounds like we probably shouldn't do a lot of static stretching.
Right.
What would you recommend?
So first, it depends on the demands of their particular sport. So let's talk about Olympic weightlifting, for example. Obviously, those athletes are going to have to be able to put a barbell over their head. So it would be necessary for them to do the drills that they need to do in order for that barbell to be able to land in the position they need it to land on. And that most likely is going to require some amount of static stretching.
Mm, good point.
So you need to be able to access the range of motion that you need for your particular sport. That's the first thing. So why are you stretching is the first question you need to ask yourself. Are you stretching because there's a range of motion that you need to access for your particular sport? Are you stretching because it feels good? Are you stretching because you feel like there's a restriction? Or what's the reason why you're stretching?
Mm. Okay.
For me, the most valid one is I need to access it for whatever activity I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay. The first one.
Now, are you more likely to do static stretches personally or like a kin stretch from FRC, something like that?
So in FRC, there is actually a portion of it that suggests to you for you to do static stretching.
Mm-hmm.
So it's I think it's like a three-step process where the first one is a 2-minute long static stretch, and then you do some PNF style contractions to access even more range.
So you gain the range of motion, but now you have to access it. So there's like two parts to that.
Exactly. Okay. And then you do the CARS pales and rails,
right,
where you strengthen the range of motion that you found.
Now you take it through its full range.
Mm-hmm. Now I know individuals can vary dramatically, but do you have a general like pre-squat, pre-deadlift, pre-bench press? Those are the three big power lifts. Like priming session that you like to recommend to people? Is there like a general one that you like to recommend?
No, I like to recommend for people to find whatever they need to do personally for their squat, bench, and deadlift.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't, why would you ask me what I do? Because my mobility restrictions or my requirements are probably completely different to yours.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because I think that you see that a lot like on YouTube and Instagram, and you'll see people talk about it, what worked really well for them, and that becomes what they're providing everybody in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are some of the ones that you do for yourself?
Not much, to be honest with you.
Mm.
When I'm pretty comfortable with squatting, there's no particular mobility move that I need to do in order to get in a better position. Same for bench and for deadlifts, maybe for sumo a little bit to open up my hips.
Mm-hmm.
I do some hip 90-90s. I do some Cossack squats side to side to open up my hips a little bit more. Maybe some Bulgarian split squats with a reach for my QL.
Because those are areas that you've identified.
For me, that I feel like restrict me in my movement.
How do you feel about split stance and unilateral type exercises for power lifters who, obviously, their lifts involve both legs together, whether you're deadlifting or squatting?
How often would you program that?
Yeah, what are the value in doing like a lunge or a Bulgarian split stance squat for somebody who just wants to get a better squat and deadlift?
Is this someone who just started powerlifting or is this an experienced powerlifter?
Let's talk about both. So let's say someone just started.
Okay. So I like to think about people who just, so powerlifting is an extremely specific sport. Obviously there's only three movements that you're being tested at and they are only in one plane. So I think the mistake that a lot of beginner powerlifters make is they specialize too early and they completely ignore any other plane of motion, any other movement, any other skill, any other thing that might benefit them that is not directly resembling that movement.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really have a name for it, but I like to think about it as kind of broad-based training or GPP, however you want to call it, where when someone's getting into a specific sport, I think it would be beneficial for them to master a wide array of movements and be comfortable with jumping, maybe some snatching, maybe some cleaning, sprinting, moving side to side, jumping side to side, just for them to be able to understand their body, how it works, how it moves, and be more coordinated, have better proprioception, better awareness, so that they, when they go into a more specific movement, they're just more athletic and they are able to refine that skill even better.
So start general. This is actually, we had a coach on a while ago who worked with kids, and he said the same thing. When they first start out, it's far better to give them general performance, you know, improvements, and then as they got older or more, then it becomes more specialized.
Yeah, you start honing in on that.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's the same advice that you'd give.
Absolutely, and it's a great question because a lot of times I get asked on podcasts or interviews what my training looks like today, and I get asked that question by other aspiring athlete powerlifters as well, and I think they're asking the wrong question because what I'm doing today is not what got me here in the first place. I mean, I told you, right? I started lifting weights 8 years ago. I started with CrossFit. And when I was doing Olympic weightlifting, I was training 9 times per week. That is a lot of squats.
Yes.
I was squatting 9 times per week. So that's a lot of reps. That was a lot of opportunity for me to refine one specific skill or a group of specific skills. And while I was doing that at the same time, I was always doing strongman exercises, carrying stones or carrying sandbags and doing yoke carries and sprinting and doing all sorts of different movements that allow me to become the athlete I am today.
Yeah.
So,
and I read that you do some unconventional stuff for your training. And I say unconventional in the context of powerlifting, like circuits and athletic type of, you know, training, things that you typically don't see. Powerlifters typically do not do circuits. They typically don't rest less than, you know, a minute. That would be their fast.
You don't think anything cardiovascular with powerlifting.
Yeah, but you do that as part of your training. Why?
Mostly, I don't do it all year round. That's the most important piece of the answer. I think that the delineation of on and off seasons is particularly important for powerlifters and Olympic weightlifters too. We don't have, at least in powerlifting, we don't really have kind of like a main event that everyone's training, everyone in powerlifting trains for. Like, for example, CrossFitters have the CrossFit Games.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
So then they'll have a season where they focus on strength, a season where they focus on endurance, a season where they're focused on improving their, refining their skills, etc. But for us, we're not all training for the same meets. Everyone trains for whatever meet is more convenient for them in terms of maybe the location and the time of the year, right? But what happens with, what are these people doing the rest of the year? Are they taking the time, are they taking time off? Are they taking enough time or are they doing some cardio to improve their cardiovascular system and improve their work capacity and endurance? What are they doing the rest of the year? And that's what I'm trying to get at, is that these circuits, these unconventional training that I do doesn't happen year round. It happens based on just the season. So if I'm, let's say, 3 months out of a meet, you'll likely not see me do a lot of those things. But if I'm 6 months out of a meet, then most of my training is actually going to be circuit-based. Just trying to have fun in the gym, trying to get out of the, or further from the powerlifting mentality of coming to the gym and having to hit a specific number. Just coming in, having fun, moving different ways, improving my cardio, being healthier, et cetera.
Now, some people, I think, would think, if I change my training, even though in the off season, I'm going to lose my progress for my specific sport, which may be powerlifting. And so I don't want to move away from that because I'm not going to get the same strength gains. Do you think your approach is leading to better performances, or do you think it's holding you back in terms of extreme performance in powerlifting?
I don't know. I mean, my performance speaks for itself. I've been able to improve every year. But I don't 100% neglect powerlifting movements when I'm in the off season. Say, well, right now I'm only squatting twice a week in prep for my next competition. But if I'm in the off season, maybe I'll squat once every 10 days. You know, I'll deadlift once every 2 weeks. I'll keep doing those movements, just not at the same frequency as I would if I was preparing for a competition.
And then the closer you get to the competition, the more you do those and the less you do of the other alternative kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Now, you're in a unique situation. There's very few people like you in the sense that you don't see a whole lot of extremely high performing strength athletes that also have the educational background that you have. It's actually quite rare. One of our good friends, Jordan Shallow, is one of those people, strength athlete,
right.
But also very, very educated.
Like Lane Norton.
Yeah, Lane Norton, another guy. But you're like at the top of your game and you have that education. I have to imagine, because in our space, there's a lot of annoying information that comes out. Like, we see things like, gosh, that is just not correct. That's not accurate. Are there things that you see that just, because of your background in education, where you shake your head and go, like, that's not right. Like, are the things that just annoy the hell out of you? Like, what are the things that annoy you the most about strength and building muscle and all the information that we get through the fitness industry?
I mean, I don't want to fire any shots at anyone. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot. I can't think of a particular example, but it's a big problem just with everyone being in control of what they post and there being absolutely no regulations as far as what anyone can say and what your credentials have to be in order for you to be able to put that information out there. I think it's become a real problem.
What about when women say, I don't want to squat or deadlift because I heard it's going to make my waist big. I'm going to get a big
blocky
waist.
Are we still talking about that, you think? People still think that?
Believe it or not, yes. I still hear that all the time. You don't hear that anymore?
Yeah, maybe a little bit.
When you're talking about the general public, I know it's hard because we get a lot of times in our own bubble and even the podcasting bubble in general, we think everybody is, you know, privy to all this stuff, but it's still out there.
Yeah. How do you reply to that?
Is it true that it grows your...
Do I think it's true?
Yeah.
No, not at all. That's why I picked that one because I think it's so frustrating and annoying. Maybe you don't hear it as much, but we hear it all the time where people are like, no, I don't want to squat. I heard it gets my waist big. I want to keep a small waist.
No, I'm kidding. I know it happens. I actually made a video, a 2-minute long video about it recently.
Oh, did you?
Oh, you did?
Yes. Nice. Where I think it was titled, Does Lifting Make Me Bulky?
Uh-huh.
And it got like maybe 5,000 shares on Instagram.
Oh, wow. Wow, yeah.
So, and people tagging others. See, told you.
Yeah.
Tagging their friends.
Oh, totally. It's such a absolutely frustrated one. There was an example you wanted to bring up in regards to, I think it was research. I never heard of this, but we have it written up there, the 6 blind men and an elephant.
Mm-hmm.
What was it that you wanted to bring up about that? There was something you wanted to say about how people view research and it was fascinating, but then we stopped and then we started the podcast.
Yeah, I've heard this analogy before, but go ahead.
I can't remember like exactly where it originated from, but basically it's a story about 6 blind men that have never encountered an elephant in their life. They've never seen it. They've never been in contact with it. They don't know what it looks like or what it feels like.
Mm-hmm.
And so they go to a room and they each are told to touch a different part of the elephant, just one part. So one person say touches the belly, one person touches the trunk, one person touches a tail, and they each have to say what they think it is. And they say it with absolute confidence. This is a wall. This is a snake. This is a broom. This is, I don't know what else. And it just, I think that that's one of the things that happens with research and let's just stick to the topic of fitness in general, how people are so fast to draw absolute truths based on one single subjective experience.
Mm. Yeah, that is a good analogy because they're all right, but they're all wrong.
Exactly.
At the same time.
Exactly.
So looking forward, what's in store for you? You've done some amazing things already. Do you have any goals that you could air on the podcast and things that you're training towards that you think you'd like to accomplish moving forward?
I want to, at some point, drop down a weight class and compete in the 114 class, hopefully take some records in that class as well. I also want to bump up a weight class and just see how strong I can get without being in a calorie restricted state, which I am most of the time. So I'd be interested to see just how strong I can get and eating as much as I can and how heavy I can get too. Nice. That sounds exciting as well.
So you have the record in the current weight class?
I have the deadlift record.
The deadlift record, mm-hmm. which was 501?
530.
What is the record at the lower weight class that you want to try and get down to and then break?
It's like 405.
405?
Yeah. Oh. And then I also have the deadlift in the heavier weight class too.
Oh, you do? Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, yeah. I feel like you'd be able to do that then, no problem. That's a pretty big damn difference.
If I can cut down and not lose any strength, which is a challenge.
How would you approach that and try not to lose strength? Just get as lean as possible? Try and just shed body fat?
Yeah, a long cut. So say I'm starting around 128, 129. Cut to about, if I can get myself down to 121, then I just do a water cut to 114. That doesn't sound too bad.
Mm. Yeah, I think you would own that at that weight. Absolutely.
The thing that it's hard because the leaner that you are, the hardest it is to lose any sort of, obviously, body fat and water as well.
Yeah, and you're lean.
Yeah.
You don't walk around heavy or whatever. Every time you post a picture or whatever, I'm looking at you now.
I'm lean all the time.
What do you walk around at body fat percentage wise?
I don't know. I've never measured it.
Really?
Maybe I should.
Yeah, you're in the teens. You're pretty damn lean all the time. It's, yeah. So Well, I tell you what, we really appreciate what you're doing because the information you're presenting is accurate. Mm-hmm. And you're somebody that is performing at a very, very high level. And that's good because you're reaching more people with the right information. So we really appreciate that. That's why we invited you on the show. And thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Mind Pump. If your goal is to build and shape your body, dramatically improve your health and energy, and maximize your overall performance, check out our discounted RGB Super Bundle at mindpumpmedia.com. The RGB Super Bundle includes MAPS Anabolic, MAPS Performance, and MAPS Aesthetic, 9 months of phased expert exercise programming designed by Sal, Adam, and Justin to systematically transform the way your body looks, feels, and performs. With detailed workout blueprints and over 200 videos, the RGB Super Bundle is like having Sal, Adam, and Justin as your own personal trainers, but at a fraction of the price. The RGB Super Bundle has a full 30-day money-back guarantee, and you can get it now plus other valuable free resources at mindpumpmedia.com. If you enjoy this show, please share the love by leaving us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes and by introducing Mind Pump to your friends and family. We thank you for your support, and until next time, this is Mind Pump.